podcast has been organized by the Low Residency MFA in Creative Writing Program at Dominican University of California under the direction of Dr. Judy Halebski in collaboration with the Communication and Media Studies Department and Penguin Radio.
Well, you guys, this is Nancy's thesis, and she has been... I'm sorry, I'm reading this text. Nancy's been working very diligently at this thesis. We chose a section of her screenplay to share that I thought would run 20 minutes. It runs twice as long as that, but we'll start we'll start it as soon as we can. So I think we'll enjoy hearing it. And our actors have rehearsed and are ready.
Great.
And I am seeing so many dear Theater View Gun friends. Great. We'll hear from Nancy's craft talk and then we'll have the read through. So Nancy's been hard at work. She's got a fantabulous screenplay, two of them that she's created here at the MFA, and we'll be hearing tonight from her most recent one. Welcome, Nancy.
Okay, thank you, Judy. I put a handout up here in the chat in case anybody wants to see the works cited and in the craft talk. I mentioned a few books and a few movies, and I think I'd just like to begin with a brief synopsis of the two screenplays, and then I might repeat the one for Brightwood again later, but... The first screenplay has to do with ultra runners in the future. Troy Whatley is a naturally talented ultra runner who is pitted against a genetically designed perfect specimen. And the only obstacle to his winning is himself and his neurotic needs. Brightwood is a tale of Dr. Melissa Grant, an MD, who is an infectious disease specialist, must travel back in time to get a DNA marker for immunity against the Black Death or the bubonic plague in 1665 London and a small village outside of London called Brightwood, where it's been self-quarantined and there's an abundance of immune people where she can obtain this marker. So I'll jump right into, so my talk is entitled Plot Versus Character. And I was telling Judy, it's not really so much plot versus character as it's plot and character. And it's kind of a personal journey that I experienced in the initial writing and rewrites as we go along. I talk about what I've learned with each rewrite. So, and it does involve plot and character. In a discussion of plot versus character, I'll begin with genre. Not the usual set of genres, such as love and revenge, or those put forth by Robert McKee in his book Story, such as horror, Western comedy, and the like, but rather those outlined in Save the Cat by Blake Snyder, based on what is happening in the story. For instance, his genre, Out of the Bottle, applies to movies such as Freaky Friday and The Nutty Professor, containing a wish, a spell, and a lesson. Institutionalized applies to movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or The Godfather, where the main character joins a family or a literal institution, such as the asylum and cuckoo's nest. The genre has its own set of rules. Join it, burn it down, or commit suicide. According to Snyder, Michael Corleone in The Godfather II commits suicide as he, after killing off most of his family members, is virtually dead. Another genre of Blake's, The Golden Fleece, is often a road movie with a team in pursuit of a prize, such as Saving Private Ryan or Ocean's 11. And a subgenre of Golden Fleece is Solo Fleece, in which the main character pursues his or her own goal as an individual. The genre for my screenplay, Anomaly Zero, That's the one about the ultra runners, seemed to be a golden fleece with a team racing for a prize. But on developing the main character, Troy, it became a solo fleece. With plot development, it felt more institutionalized as Troy gets drawn into a battle of wills between the sponsor and his underlings, its underlings. So the genre became a question. Is it solo fleece or is it institutionalized? Our alumna, Bogey, who is here tonight, reminded me that the screenplay may contain elements of several genres. So hence, with the completion of the first draft, I reached a compromise. The character story is institutionalized, but with a solo fleece structure, namely, Troy joins a team but races for himself. And here's my technical expertise that I'm going to try to do. And Tom showed me this little thing here. So we have a chart. Yay! As outlined in many craft books, the main plot points must be laid out, such as the character setup or Troy trains constantly, the inciting incident, Troy gets the sponsorship, the debate, Troy says goodbye to his family, the midpoint, in this case, is a false victory, Troy runs under his own strength, dark night of the soul, Troy enters rehab with a broken leg, and the finale, or storming the castle, Troy overcomes adversity and wins the last race. I get a kick out of the finale in particular. Blake Snyder always says, in every story you've ever seen, the finale has five segments. You gather the team, and I kind of can't help thinking about Avengers when I think of gathering the team, storming the castle, the high tower surprise, dig down deep and executing the plan. You gather the team. This is everybody that's been with you the whole journey. Like in the Golden Fleece, you have the team racing for the prize. You get them all together to try to accomplish the goal, like in Saving Private Ryan. What do you know? There's a high tower surprise. For instance, if they're trying to rescue a princess, she's no longer there, and that's a surprise. Then the hero has to dig down deep. In my case, Troy actually sees like a figure of a jaguar running next to him in his final race. He digs down deep and he executes the plan. And the final image is, Schneider always says, have a very powerful final image. He wins the race. So I always think of the Saving the Princess deal when I think of the finale. Snyder even lays out the pages where the plot points are to take place. And since publication of Save the Cat, I think it was in 2005, many screenwriters have adhered strictly to this chart. However, if you follow it too closely, the work may be pegged by some readers as saving the cat. I've even heard readers will say, this guy's trying to save the cat, toss the script on the floor, it's too formulaic. Thus, the chart is useful in planning, but should not be used to the detriment of creativity. For a bit of background, Anomaly Zero was inspired several years ago when I watched an Olympic marathon. One of the finalists fell down from exhaustion and a debate ensued as to whether to help him get up. He got up on his own and finished, not first, but down the line. So the question was, what made him get up? And further, in a race to whom someone, everything comes easy, such as the genetically designed perfect specimen, who would prevail? Thus, the idea of a struggling runner, Troy, versus a genetically designed specimen came about. The solo fleece provided the race framework, but Troy's personal arc had yet to be fully developed. In recalling what made the Olympic marathoner get up, at least two reasons came to mind: honor for the village or money from endorsements. As Troy was not from a small remote village, an eternal goal came to mind. That of fulfilling a promise to his father, compounded by guilt for not running fast enough. For examples of a personal arc within a competitive framework, I watched the movies Creed 1 and Creed 2. Those sequels to Rocky have many of the same characters as Rocky. Adonis Creed is the son of Apollo Creed. The coach is now Rocky, and his rival is Victor, the son of Ivan Drago. The genre is solo fleece because Creed is trying to attain his own goals. But instead of races, it has multiple bouts, an initial bout, a midpoint bout, and the final victory. Within the structure, Creed is trying to live up to his father's reputation. And so I saw a parallel a little bit there with Troy. There's a conflict with his mother and his pregnant wife who is worried about injury, but ultimately Creed must decide for himself whether or not to continue boxing. Seeing the character's arc within the solo fleece helped to clarify the interaction between plot and character for Anomaly Zero. In the second place screenplay, Brightwood, about the bubonic plague in 1665 London, the choice of genre was more easily reached. The screenplay started out as character-driven with an individual goal, so solo fleece was the first choice. There was no institution, only the plague and the goal of finding a cure. So the challenge then was to pose obstacles that fall into the protagonist's path. Again, there were the main plot points to identify. The character's setup: Melissa is orderly and meticulous. The inciting incident: Melissa goes back in time. The debate or break to second act: she finds her living situation, a nemesis, and a romance. A midpoint: she goes against doctrine and delivers a baby. Bad guys close in. Her nemesis gathers her friends to spy on her. The nemesis gets injured, which sets off the third act of a chase to get back to the time portal. Lissa's failure to achieve her goal, which is the dark night of the soul for her. And the finale: after the Hightower surprise, she obtains an alternate cure for the bubonic plague. In researching examples for Brightwood, a semi-historical screenplay, I watched the film Harriet, about Harriet Tubman, in which Harriet escapes to a northern city and encounters obstacles, but finds points of sanctuary and uses these to create the Underground Railroad. She achieves her goal at the midpoint, but returns to the farm to help friends and family escape under her leadership and inspiration. In Brightwood, Lissa encounters obstacles, but also gets help along the way. And after the midpoint, she obtains what she thinks is a cure for the plague and finds her way back to the time portal. As a cultural resource for Brightwood, Judy recommended the book, A Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe. I don't know if any of you have read that. The book yields a rich trove of historical context for the story, including sights and sounds of the period. So I'm going to stop the screen share. Okay, we're all still here, so I haven't screwed that up. Okay, good. Getting back to character. After choosing the genre and laying out the plot points, additional resources were needed for the character's development. Because Anomaly started out as plot-driven, and in order to determine the main character's personal struggle, I recall the central premise of the book, The Art of Dramatic Writing by Laos Egri, which says, determine the film's theme, then pick a character who would do the theme. Egri uses A Doll's House by Henrik Ibsen as an example. The play's theme can be summarized as selfishness leads to loneliness. I like to say these themes in like a three word phrase. The characterization then became a controlling, selfish husband denies his wife funds and she leaves him. So that selfishness leads to loneliness. There's an old saying, neurotic energy can drive freight trains. If the theme of Anomalies can be described as struggle and sacrifice wins the race, it would follow that the main character would have an intensely personal, perhaps neurotic struggle to drive him over the finish line. But internal needs, such as fulfilling a promise or seeking forgiveness, can be difficult to portray on screen. One solution is to show inner conflict through flashbacks, such as Troy's father has fallen and Troy runs to get help but can't get back in time. His father's death instills a neurotic need in Troy to train faster and faster. The constant training pays off but falls short in satisfying his desire for forgiveness. And even though he learns to rely on his training for self-control, he can never be ostensibly forgiven by his dead father. It therefore became necessary to show his father's forgiveness through a metaphysical act, such as a shower of shooting stars, something they viewed together. In addition to theme is the edict and craft books that the main character must change. Hence, if the theme for Brightwood is orderliness and self-control do not equal success, or conversely, living spontaneously leads to happiness, then it would be appropriate for Lissa to start out uptight and orderly, wiping up coffee spills, and end up planting indoor flowers with her five-year-old daughter, scattering dirt everywhere. The lessons she learns in Brightwood lead her to a 180-degree change in lifestyle. Similarly, Troy goes from neurotic runner to confident, self-actualized winner. This satisfies the theme, struggle wins the race. One may conclude then, theme equals change, and that just kind of popped out, and I think that's another paper. So anyway, theme equals change. Further character development comes through in the actual process of writing and rewriting. For example, in the initial draft of Anomaly Zero, by focusing mainly on plot, the dialogue was placeholder. I had to go back into the character's backstory and delve more deeply into Troy's psyche in order to improve both character and dialogue. Techniques for dialogue improvement required further research. A filmmaker on social media, and I don't remember his name, had achieved some success with his stories, but he expressed that his dialogue felt forced. He seemed to be writing from plot, not character. He asked his friend to collaborate in refining his dialogue. When his friend was asked the secret for good dialogue, he responded, "Read a lot of books, listen to people talking, and then just write as if people are talking." Coincidentally, his friend seemed very well tuned in to contemporary wit and humor. In her book, You Talking to Me, How to Write Great Dialogue, Linda Seeger advises the writer to simply know your character inside and out. The title of the book refers to the famous scene in Taxi Driver in which Robert De Niro talks to himself in the mirror. You talking to me? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. The dialogue works brilliantly, even though it was ad-libbed by De Niro. But to his credit, De Niro drove a taxi 15 hours a day for a month preparing for the role. He knew that character inside and out. In rewriting Brightwood with an emphasis on character, this is another rewrite. In one particular scene, one character emerged the leader, taking charge of the action. In the scene, shortly after Lissa meets Dorothea Dudley for the first time, Dorothea reveals that she has the plague and will remain behind while her husband flees London with the two boys. Her husband is frozen to the spot. Dorothea orders him to leave without her for the sake of the boys. Her action jolts Dudley out of his shock and enables him to carry on. It became apparent in each scene that I needed to determine who is in charge, what they aim to accomplish, and how their action moves the story. With this information, Dorothea's backstory evolved from a simple wife into a strong matron with feet firmly planted on the ground, able to be self-sacrificing in the moment of need. In a rewrite of another rewrite of Anomaly Zero, Bob Bartlett's backstory evolves from a salesman who looks like money to a former athlete who works hard and rises up the ranks to middle manager who protects the CEO to his own detriment. So that elongated out and it helped in the writing. Troy's backstory evolved to show that while he is neurotic, he possesses inner security and strength. The challenge became that he was non-distinctive or vanilla in the early scenes, while his inner strength shone through later. According to Snyder, lead characters in Golden Fleece movies are often vanilla. So that gave me heart, especially when, like Luke Skywalker, they are surrounded with colorful characters like Han Solo, Chewbacca, and others. However, vanilla lead characters are usually seen as a drawback. Readers earmark a main character vanilla if he or she asks too many questions instead of giving answers, and or whether all the other characters have all the best lines. It could be argued that although Luke starts out the reluctant hero, he learns at the midpoint to use the Force by training blindfolded with his lightsaber. Similarly, Troy at his midpoint learns he can use his new muscle fiber to win a race. By realizing their powers at the midpoint, both characters use those powers later on to carry them through the finale. It could be said that both Lyssa and Troy, because they are tasked with their goals, are reluctant heroes. But craft authors agree, whether reluctant or not, the hero must choose. Therefore, Troy must choose the sponsorship and Lyssa must choose to go back in time to save the world. A structural note from an outside reader was that Troy's midpoint victory felt like game over. In Anomalies, it seemed important for the midpoint victory to be a false victory, leaving room for the true victory at the finale. But like Luke Skywalker practicing with his lightsaber, the midpoint should only be a hint of what is to come. This would support Snyder's advice to plan the plot points carefully, that chart. And like McKee, he says that each plot point should have a positive or negative charge. McKee likens these charges to a piston engine, sparking the action and propelling it forward. Therefore, planning plot points carefully, including the midpoint, will help ensure a steady rise in dramatic action. So I'm going to try my tech wizardry again. And so a lot of people will use index cards, colorful index cards, and they can lay them out just like the chart I just showed you. You can lay them out let's see if I can get to, oh, hang on. Okay. I was going to go to the chart again, but I'm going to go back to my index card. Okay. Are you all there? Here we go. Sorry. Going back to my plot point again. Oh, I see. Okay, can you guys see that? Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can see
okay.
It and hear.
Okay, great. Looks so good. The two authors, I got lost there. I saw the index cards, but I couldn't see you guys. The two authors suggest placing the scenes on index cards, lay them out like according to that chart, showing, and I'm going to go up to the other one. It keeps going out on me. Okay, so here's the one I wanted to show you. There you go. See the plus and minus sign there? That's the positive and negative charges that McKee's talking about. So what he recommends is having your cards laid out and they have an up and down ending. And you want to have each scene go plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, just like a piston engine running. And that will make your story move. The arrows are the conflict in the story. How does it turn? What happens? And so that's just a helpful hint there on the to get everything laid out and plotted out in advance. After rewriting again, with an emphasis on character, another rewrite was needed, mainly to just tell the story. So I've got a lot of things figured out, but it's imperative to know exactly what the story is. I kind of had a lot of balls in the air. The synopsis then, if not clear, must be revised and spelled out for both character and story. So synopsis, yeah, that helps. Following story and character development, Ken Miyamoto from the blog screencraft.org and writer on the TV series Blackout advises to, within each scene, break up chunks of dialogue with action lines whenever possible, rather than use parenthetical directions or the word pause. I'm going to stop this share. Okay. For example, and I was using the word pause a lot to break up my speeches. And some of them are natural pauses, and some you actually have no choice but to use the word pause. But for example, in the scene where Bob Bartlett in Anomalies is selling Troy on the sponsorship, information pops up on his computer screen. Instead of adding a parenthetical direction of surprise, an action line could be inserted. Troy's parents' names pop up on the screen, prompting Bob's line of dialogue, "Milt, I remember him." The scene is enhanced and the lengthy speech is broken up. So those action lines really help. But a word of caution concerning action lines: the first draft of Anomalies felt long and drawn out. Action was described in great detail when only a few words would do. For example, a description of the training campus started out, the long winding road led up to campus above the clouds, was later streamlined to Think Overlook in The Shining. By removing the overwriting, the script read a lot faster. And I did notice that I got a lot better feedback from a couple of readers. Thus, in the latest rewrite, I went scene by scene in both scripts, breaking up dialogue with action lines. By adding action, or in theatrical terms, business, dialogue became more conversational. The characters responded to one another more. At the same time, I could better visualize the scene and hear the characters. With the characters doing more interacting, the scenes became more lifelike. The scene in which Lissa meets the immune boy, Benjamin, at the almshouse, attempting to gain his trust, morphed from a simple scene where two people just meet into a scene where the boy shies away, equates Lissa with mommy, mourns the loss of family, confides in Lissa, and ends with a fast and trusting friendship. Thus, with the genre chosen, the plot points planned out, the characters' backstories developed, the story itself clarified, and finally, by adding action lines to the scene, the scripts seem to develop more dimensionally. At least they seem to me. There's an oft-used quote from William Goldman, writer of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and author of the book Adventures in the Screen Trade, in which he sums up the entertainment industry: nobody knows anything. He thinks everyone has different opinions and no one has a corner on what works and what doesn't. But in gathering advice and tips from a myriad of writers, whether from books, blogs, or Twitter feeds, along with the helpful guidance of professors at Dominican and the Band of Poets and everybody else, a writer's work can improve. At least that's the hope. So thank you very much. I am excited for the reading.
So. Nancy, thank you so much. What a wonderful showing of the work you've been doing. Such a thoughtful presentation. Just great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yeah. I had thought we would have questions, but we are not taking questions at this point in time. We're moving straight on to the reading. And I want to give a warm welcome to the Theater of Eugen Company. They're a theater company based in San Francisco. They do fantastic, wonderful work. Much of it is inspired by contemporary theater, influenced by Japanese performance traditions, or staging traditional Japanese theater forms. It's a company I've worked with and I admire, and I'm so glad to have them here with us. I hope that you'll be able to see some of the other work they do. It's varied, it's multifaceted, it's illuminating and exciting. They have their theater space is called, is it Theater of Eugen? It's in Project Artaud in downtown San Francisco. So maybe, you know, when we're back coughing on each other and hugging, you can catch a show there sometimes. Nancy, thanks for the fantastic craft talk. Now we're gonna welcome our actors and we have some instructions. Would like to ask, the theater is called No Space in Project Artaud, N-O-H for No Theater with the Mask. And if you wanna learn more about that, you can read my dissertation. It's only 300 pages, which has a full chapter on Theater of Eugen and their founding director, Yuriko Doi. So there's a couple of things we're gonna proceed to do. We're gonna pin the actors, hopefully, so that they will be at the top of your screen. And we also thought that it would work really well if the rest of us closed down our video and turned off our video so we're seeing the actors' faces. And you might also wanna put yours on spotlight depending on what might work best for you. So again, warm welcome to Theater of Eugen. They're gonna read an excerpt of Nancy's Brightwood script.
Judy, do you want me to talk about where we're at in the story or?
So Nancy, we're gonna actually start it a little bit further in than the excerpt we planned.
Okay, great. That's fine.
Because the excerpt was actually too long. And our theater experts have, we're starting with, what's the scene we're gonna, where are we starting in?
We're starting in on page 31 of the script, page 8 of the excerpt. When Lisa wanders over to the church.
Oh, great. Okay, that's in Act 2.
Nancy, do you want to give any more intro to it than that?
That's pretty adequate.
So Lisa's the scientist main character, and she's traveled back in time to find someone who is immune to the plague.
Right, exactly. And so she's arrived.
Pre-modern Britain.
Right. And she's arrived in the small town of Brightwood, and she's been kind of thrown out by the Dudleys, and she's wandered the streets, and she came to a tavern and found her way over to the church. And I think that's where they're going to pick up. So it's kind of not exactly midpoint, but close.
Great.
So
fantastic.
Thank you, everyone.
Just a couple of reminders. We're going to keep our microphones on mute. And if you're an audience member, please shut off your camera so that it just focuses on the actor's faces. And I will do the same.
Great. Thank you for having us. Without further ado, we will begin with the excerpt from Brightwood. Exterior church, same time. Lisa wanders over to the church and makes her way up the steps. It is full of people huddled together praying. Pastor Albert Ballard, 40, is at the pulpit in a black frock. Lisa squeezes into a pew and distances herself.
And never lose sight of that fact. The Lord turns his eyes from your, the Lord turns not his eyes from your face. He sees your tears. He knows your sorrow. Face him with your heart. Tell him you know he has not failed you. Repent, and the Lord will bless ye.
He closes the Bible, and parishioners drift out the door. A few go up to him to receive his blessing. He places his hand on their heads as they weep. On their way out, several look sidelong at Lisa, tall with good teeth. A skinny old parishioner, Mr. Mathiason, with teeth missing, sidles up alongside her.
He's a good un, the pastor. To cement in faith like bonbons. We likes him.
He must be a great comfort.
We miss our old one, though. He died, from the distemper. Ballard's a dissenter, but we takes what we can get.
Oh, a dissenter.
Can't hold that against him, though. The church needs new ideas now and then. All's the same to me.
He bows his head in prayer, and Lisa bows her head also. He rises.
Well, 'tis a lonely night for an old man, but a warm bed is better than this hard seat, and my knees have practically gone out from kneeling. Good luck to you, miss.
Thank you, sir. Most kindly.
The eyes of heaven upon ye.
Lisa remains in the quiet pew. She looks around at the iconic imagery, the statue of Jesus and the burning candles. Then, tired and hungry, she falls asleep, slumped over the back of the pew in front of her. Dissolved 2 hours later, Lisa is awakened by the pastor. She looks up into his piercing blue eyes and kind face.
Now come along, miss. Is it home you be wanting to go? 'Tis late.
No, sir. I've been tossed out. Well, not actually tossed, but the family has the distemper and they're not wanting to put me in any danger.
Aye. 'Tis a kindness they're doing you. You're welcome to pray with us as long as you want.
You are most kindly, sir. I'll be no trouble. Honest, I won't.
He looks away, then back at her. He notices her clean hands and manicured fingers.
I've a mind to introduce you to our housekeeper and midwife, Patricia. Mind ye a bit of work? I suppose it's not fitting for one of your sort, but we can barely make do with all the chores. It's practically all ours.
I'd be most beholden to you. I can cook a bit too.
Patricia does all that, but my constitution could use a respite from all the rum she puts in the pudding.
They laugh. She follows him to the altar. He kneels before the statue of Jesus and prays. She takes her cue and kneels also. Patricia, a stout 40, Scottish peasant with a red face, enters. She looks askance at Lisa.
Master!
Patricia! Meet. I'm afraid I don't know your name.
It's Lisa, sir.
Pat, take Lisa upstairs and give her the closet next to your room. If I think there's an extra mattress in there, in the morning you can show her the kitchen. She says she can cook.
I've no need in that regard, sir. But a scullery maid of them, what to use for?
Ballard shoots Lisa a questioning look.
Oh, I can do that too. I'm a whiz, a wonderful maid. I'm not afraid to face a bucket nor a mop neither.
Then 'tis done, at least until you can find your way. Where is it you come from?
Newbury, by way of London. Our house was shut up.
Nasty business to shut up decent folks with no one to pray over them.
Aye, sir.
Interior, church spiral staircase, moments later. Lisa follows Patricia up the spiral staircase to the tower, where she finds a closet with a bed. Interior, church closet, same time. Patricia lights the candle. She leaves and brings back a chamber pot, a pitcher of water, and a washbowl.
Thank you, Patricia. You're most kind.
We be rising at dawn. I'll wake you. After that, it's you who'll be waking me.
She closes the heavy wooden door. Lisa opens the window and gazes out into the night air. She removes the DNA collection kit from her leg and places it next to the washbowl. She takes an orange out of her bag and peels it. The door suddenly opens and Patricia sticks her head inside.
Oh, forgot to give you a blanket.
Lisa moves in front of her kit. Patricia looks at her suspiciously.
Would you like some orange?
Patricia's eyes light up. Lisa slices some off with her knife and hands it to Patricia. Lisa places the blanket over her kit. Patricia savors the orange and smiles. Lisa lifts a corner of the blanket.
Thanks ever so much. It is a bit chilly.
Patricia looks around again to make sure nothing is amiss and banks out the door.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Lisa holds the blanket out the window and shakes it. She then carefully inspects the mattress and the corners of the room for fleas. She washes her hands as thoroughly as possible.
I must ask for some soap in the morning.
She removes her blue contact lenses from her brown eyes and places them in a small box and hides it with her DNA kit. She hears muffled voices from below. Interior, church spiral staircase later. She tiptoes down the stairs and watches Patricia and the pastor argue through a crack in the door.
Oh, I've cooked and scrubbed here nigh on 20 years, and I give you the doubt because you knew, but I hadn't never seen a pastor what takes in a stray cat that you never have seen before.
Pat, there's so many outside need your help and succor during these times. You work so hard. Jesus sent her to help you with his work. Let's pray and be thankful for sending her to us.
She had an orange.
Lisa tiptoes back up to her room. Day 3. Interior, church closet, dawn. Lisa is awakened by a bird at the window, then a squirrel, and more birds.
What do you think this is? Cinder Frickinella?
He reaches for the washbowl and puts in her contacts, just as Patricia enters with a bucket and a mop. Interior, church spiral staircase, moments later. Angle on Lisa's footsteps as she follows Patricia, holding mop and bucket down the stairs, past the pastor's office, past Pat's room, and out to the kitchen. Montage of Lisa's daily routine. The below street kitchen is a hive of activity as Patricia throws wheat grains into the cooking pot above the fire while Lisa chops leftover meat scraps. Breakfast at kitchen wooden table. Lisa eats porridge while Pat carries up a tray to the pastor. Ditch behind the house. Lisa empties chamber pots into the muddy ditch. She almost slips in the mud on the way back. End of montage. Interior, church kitchen, morning. As Lisa puts her mop away, a large rat scuttles across the floor. Lisa jumps. Patricia takes the broom, whomps him to death, and carries him out to the street.
Terrified of a little rat. They're harmless. Just be careful where you step at night.
There's a loud banging on the church doors. They rush outside. Exterior, church doors, moments later. A mother and father holding their sick child, Michael, 10, bang on the door. The pastor opens it.
Please, your grace, sir, 'tis the plague. Young master has the tokens. Prithee, last rites, sir, for the boy.
Did you take the physician?
There's no time, sir. It only came on him last night. He's terrible sick. Please help.
Of course we'll help. Pat, help me get him up to my chamber. Lisa, you too.
Ballard scoops up the sick youngster. Interior, church spiral staircase, moments later. The pastor carries him up the stairwell to his chamber, Pat, the mother and father, and Lisa close behind. Lisa hangs back as they lay the young boy on the pastor's bed. The pastor smooths his forehead. He lifts the boy's shirt and looks at his tokens. Some are open and oozing.
What's your name?
Michael.
Don't be afraid, Michael. You're in God's house now. He is with you, and so are we.
He's not been baptized, Reverend Sir.
You're a good boy. I can see you're pure of heart. Jesus will welcome you into his arms and love you and care for you.
He signals to Pat and Lisa.
Pat, Bring me some baptismal water. Lissa, go to town and fetch some physic from the apothecary.
Yes, sir.
Right away, sir.
Patricia and Lisa exit down the stairs. Interior church spiral staircase moments later.
Get some shillings out of the jar in the kitchen and be quick about it. Fuchsia line. Hurry.
Exterior streets of Brightwood moments later. Lisa wanders a street near the church looking for Fuchsia Lane. She passes many small shops and businesses. She turns into Fuchsia Lanes and stops cold. She's standing in front of a shop with a large sign above it that reads, Blackwell's Apothecary. Interior, Blackwell's Apothecary, moments later. She enters the shop and a bell rings. A small, older gentleman, Mr. Blackwell, wearing a monocle, greets her.
Can I help you, young lady?
Lisa Sands stocks still in front of a skull she has studied.
Yes, sir. Of course, sir. I'm in a bit of a hurry. You see, there's a young boy. He's quite ill, and...
You need some physic. What kind?
It's the distemper, sir. Tokens, many of them.
Have they opened up?
Why, yes.
That's good. It will help him heal, Lord willing. I'll get you the syrup of figs, or would you rather have the frog powder? It's quite effective.
I'll take the syrup. Thank you, sir.
He turns around and gets the syrup.
Have you been feeling well, sir?
Why, yes, miss. Why do you ask?
Do you see the distemper often?
Yes, but again, I'm well. Are you worried about the potion?
No, sir. But I'll be back. I'd like to talk with you.
All right, young miss, but it had better be soon. I'm off to London in a few days hence.
No, you mustn't. You mustn't go. I mean, please, don't go.
Miss, are you okay? Is the potion for you? Let me feel your hair.
Oh, no, not for me, sir. It's the little boy, and I'm in a dreadful hurry, but I'll return it. And I hope to see you before you go.
I hope so too, miss. Now take care, and here, don't forget your syrup.
Thank you.
Lisa packs it up and hastens out the door. She looks behind her as she goes.
Bye, Mr. Blackwell. It's so nice to make your acquaintance. Until we meet again.
That's right. Now be off and hurry.
He closes the door and the small bell rings. Exterior, streets of Brightwood, moments later. Back on the main street, she notices an astrologer's shop. Nativities read. She does a double take. There's a small wooden cage in the window with what looks like a monkey inside. She hurries on. Close to the church, she passes the cemetery. A small funeral is breaking up. It's Eric and the Dudleys. Ellen leads Eric off by motherly hand. Lisa comes closer, angle on headstone. Martha Bigley, beloved mother. Lisa crumbles in despair, but pulls herself up and keeps going. Interior, pastor's chambers, later. Lisa arrives with the physic and Pat administers it with a big silver spoon. The pastor tucks up the covers. Mother cries softly. Pat and Lisa go out into the hallway.
Nothing more to do here. I'll tidy up the sanctuary. Worshippers be coming soon.
Lisa goes down to the kitchen and hangs the tea kettle over the fire. Interior, church kitchen, evening. There's a bang at the door. A messenger with a card arrives.
For Pat, miss, a matter of urgency.
Lisa runs the card with the embossed seal up to the pastor's chamber. Interior, pastor's chamber, moments later. The boy is sitting up a little. The pastor dons his attire for the night's sermon. The mother and father sit near the boy. Lisa hands the note to Pat, who reads it.
Reverend sir, it's from her ladyship. Her daughter's about to give birth.
You go ahead. Pat, I'll dress and go downstairs, but take Lisa with you. She might be a help.
Yes, sir.
Interior, a church spiral staircase. Moments later, Lisa pauses.
Try to look decent, but hurry.
Interior, a church closet. Moments later, Lisa splashes her face and tidies her hair. She reaches into her bag for her map and her list of ancestors falls out. Her eyes fall on the names from Brightwood. Winton Ashford, Matilda Ashford, Annabella Grant, Simon Grant, Timothy Grant. She throws the list back in her bag and runs out the door. Exterior, manor house, later that night. Pat and Lisa approach the house.
No, stay out of the way and do as I say.
Yes, ma'am.
They bang the heavy door knocker on the large double doors. A servant, William, opens the door.
Come in, ladies. Her ladyship is most anxious for your attendance.
They follow William up the stairs. Interior, Ashford bedchamber, moments later. Lady Matilda Ashford wrings her hands as her daughter screams out in pain. She runs to Patricia.
Thank God you've come. She's had pain since 5 o'clock this morning.
Why didn't you send for me sooner?
It wasn't bad at first. It's gotten worse. There's no sign of the baby.
She looks over at Lisa.
Oh, this is my scullery maid, Lisa. The pastor sent her.
Patricia bends down and takes a look at the daughter and feels her belly. Lisa peeks over her shoulder.
Don't intervene. Don't intervene.
The daughter screams again. Patricia notices Lisa behind her.
Oh, I said to stay out of the way. Go get some clean clothes and some water.
Interior, Ashford stairway, moments later. Lisa hastens down the stairs. William takes her to the storeroom to get what she needs. She runs back up. Interior, Ashford bedchamber, same time. Lisa arrives to more screening. The mother is there.
Patricia, please do something.
I'm trying to, ma'am. There's not much I can do.
The mother goes over to her daughter, Lisa close by.
Annabella, please just push. You have to push. It will come. It will come.
Lisa flashes back to the list of ancestors. Annabella Grant on Lisa.
Annabella.
Did you say something?
Annabella Grant? So then you would be...
Matilda Ashford, yes. But how did you know? Captain Grant is in America.
Annabella rants, delirious.
Simon, come home, please. Come home.
Lisa goes over to Annabella.
Mind if I have a look?
Patricia lunges over and pushes Lisa out of the way.
Stand back! Stay out of the way! I told you!
Lisa pushes forward.
I'm going to have a look.
She reaches out for Annabella's hand and whispers.
Please, may I, Annabella, for the baby? He's going to be okay.
Patricia moves in again to push Lisa aside. Lisa puts out her hand and holds her at arm's length.
Okay, Annabella?
Annabella nods.
Let her look. It can't hurt to look.
Lisa lifts up the cover and feels Annabella's baby. It has not turned and descended into the vaginal canal. Lisa calls William, who is standing by the door.
Do you have any spirits? Also soap. I need to wash my hands.
You'll not touch her.
You don't know anything about me. Look, all you need to know is I can do this. So please, Pat, step aside.
Lisa rips up some of the bedclothes around Annabella to make some additional cloths.
Sorry, Dr. Watkins. Sorry, world.
With copious amounts of rum poured down Annabella and hands washed, Lisa puts her hands in, reaches up into the vaginal canal, and turns the baby. With a last giant scream, Annabella pushes down, and the baby is born. Lady Ashford, Annabella, and William cry, rejoicing. Winton and George rush up the stairs.
It's a miracle. Oh, thank you, Lisa. Thank you so much.
Hi, Timothy.
I was going to name him that. But how did you...
Just a hunch.
Pat stands in the background, her face a deep purple. fade out.
Thank you so much.
It's drama. What a wonderful job you guys did reading that. Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled with how well that could work over Zoom. Fantastic. Nancy, and, congratulations.
And having a girl play the old man is just perfect. I think I'm going to rewrite the whole thing. You guys were great. It's like the parts were, you knew the parts so well. I'm amazed. Thank you so much. And the narration was perfect too. Fantastic. With just a few of you, I can't believe it. You pulled it off.
Well, it's not our normal MO to be doing screenplays. And, we thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much for doing that. It made it come alive. Yeah, it was wonderful. And the accents were perfect. that's great. Every one of you, fantastic.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun. Thank you for writing this.
Absolutely. So opportunity.
Very fun. Thank you.
It's good hearing the dialogue.
Makes all the difference, right?
It does. It makes a lot of difference. It gives me a lot of ideas. Yeah. Great. And you picked the right pages too. So.
Oh, good.
I'm blown
away. Well, great. We've had. Go ahead, Nancy.
I'm blown away. That's great.
Nancy, you've worked so hard and done a great job. You know,
thank you.
You can see everyone in the chat is just chiming in and saying, fantastic, yay, great work. Wonderful.
I'm
so super exciting. Do we have, I know we're at time. Can we just get one question for Nancy and maybe she can answer one question and then we'll wrap up?
I have a question that's kind of, being a screenplay writer, sort of lover too, I've got a question for her.
Okay. I gotta watch out for Bogey.
They tend to be a little academic. okay, so you've written two screenplays now, and you've gone from the first one where you're learning how to do it, the second one where you're getting you're not only your feet wet, you've got the water up to your knees now. How has this experience going to change how you think you're going to approach your next screenplay?
That's a great question. I'm already thinking about it. And I just think there's going to be a lot more conflict, a lot more action. The characters are going to be a lot more, the word interactive comes to mind, but proactive, I believe, is the word I'm looking for. And so with Brightwood, I learned a lot in listening to the characters, hearing them and visualizing the scenes. So now I want to be action. So that'll be the next. But yeah, good question. Thank you for asking. Yeah.
Well, wonderful.
It's been a great help.
So this was fantastic. What I think we'll do now is we'll adjourn. But before we do that, Natalie will open some breakout rooms. So why don't we, anyone that wants to stay around and chat in a smaller breakout room can say a hello. I hate to wrap up things too abruptly. Natalie, are you with us? Can you make some breakout rooms kind of at random, maybe three rooms?
Yes, I'm making them right now and you should be invited to them shortly.
Okay, so this is our, so I welcome you to step into a breakout room and have a little debrief. I want to again thanks Theater of You again for joining us and doing such a fantastic job staging the screenplay and reading and making it come alive. And Nancy, just congratulations for all the wonderful work you have done.
Great job.
We'll meet at 10 a.m. tomorrow for a great workshop with Nina and alumni. So great you came back. We're so happy to see you. And we want to keep you close and engaged with us. So know that you're welcome. You're always welcome to be with us. So thank you so much. So hopefully people are getting, if
thanks,
you
actors.
Want to break your room, please do. If not, we'll see you in the morning. And again, thanks to Theater of You again.
Thank you so great. Much. You guys are great.
What time is Katie doing her?
She's starting at 5 p.m. California time tomorrow.
Okay, great.
Cool.
Tomorrow, Katie Arnold.
Yay, Katie.
Hey, Nancy. See you guys tomorrow.